Can we just a little bit of a context, if I can say, we'll have our tea. Am I not audible?
Now you are.
Oh, okay.
I'm getting old.
Thank you. We will have our, I've just picked up that members don't have the report of the public protect, which I assume was public, it's in the public domain. But I've then requested the secretariat to print some. On the other one, when the meeting is formally open, we will then explain on the other one, because there are reports that we have expected. Can we have two? And between if members propose only one item, can we have tea whilst we'll then be waiting for that report of the public protect? Come again? Can we break for tea and then we will sort that out? Come again?
When are we starting with the e-panel?
Yeah.
Yes.
To save the trees.
These are trees.
We must save the trees. I support that. I support this. Because all of us have got laptops, why can't we put them on laptops? How's the telephone?
Good.
Come in.
Welcome, Minister, and the deputies. And we have also been joined by by a member of the economic. We've also been joined by a member of the EFF, Honorable Mlaotse.
Yeah, second member.
Who is replacing the other member who didn't join us before she joined us. So you are welcome, sir. This is the portfolio committee on employing your neighbor so that you don't think you are lost. And today, out of the meetings that we had, members will remember that we had a couple of meetings, presentations by the department, by entities, and compensation fund was one of those entities that we, as the committee, felt that we need to listen more, if I can put it more mildly, on what is happening, on the challenges of the fund. It is in that context that we then requested the board, which the board came, and after that then we concluded our report. In our BRRR report last week, and interacting with it, with the challenges that have been raised by the Auditor General's report, we felt that it is imperative, it's urgent that we really recall, if I can put it that way, the compensation fund to come and take us through the action plan. And members will remember that. First, let me apologize for that. Should have ensured that members have all these the investigations that have taken place. The public protector, I assume that because the public domain members will have it, but we are organizing the copies. Members will have it, and at a particular time we'll deal with that. The one of the SIU, I think either the minister or the DG will then explain the situation around it. So today we then, as we agreed in the last meeting, that we'll dedicate this day to the compensation fund again, precisely because where it is located, who is to benefit, who is being disadvantaged, who is being challenged by the whole situation in the compensation fund. And we hope the two leaders in the department, in terms of the minister as the political head and the DG as the administrative head, to will be able to take us through and make us to really understand. Because it's not about anybody else, as I've said, it's us to have an understanding and us to move forward and take decisions that are really going to improve. I'm saying improve the situation, because for now our view is that there is work that is to be done in that space of the compensation fund for it to improve its state of affairs. I'm not going to offer the benefit of the, in particular with the new member. It's going to be important that we introduce ourselves so that he is aware who is here. I'm Linda Lotonjo, I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Employment and Labour. On my left is Zolani, who is the secretary. Next to him is Bonseni, who is the content advisor. Next to him, and don't ask me why it's all he is. I don't know. I find it like that, the boy is quiet. Next to him is the Debo, who is our researcher. At the back, on my left, at the extreme against the wall, is Poshia, who is the committee assistant. The other one is out, Colero, who is the secretary to the office of the chair. Everybody, when introducing himself or herself, we know even the guests will use the mic, because we must know who is here, your name, the full name, and the organization that you are representing. I'll then hand over to the honorable members.
Minister of Employment and Labour.
And Buitumelo Moloi, Deputy Minister, Employment and Labour.
Good morning, I'm Sibusiso Mtabe from the ANC.
From the ANC.
Good morning, everyone. The issue of boys quiet would be dealt with some other time. Anywhere it's red, it's ugly. Anyway, my name is Mungaiba Nanga from the
DGM. Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Carter.
Hi, Michael Bagram from the Democratic Alliance.
Morning, my name is Eloise Jordan, I'm from the fifth class.
Morning, everyone. Sir, so I hope no one is going to be offended if I introduce myself as the whip of the majority party in the CC. Hence, other parties, they have shadow ministers. My name is Lokhle Ngabane. I thank you, the whip.
So, can look at that.
This is
my name is Jared. My name is Mlensi Namzet, member of the ANC.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Tribad Mraudzi. I'm the member of the EFF.
And start.
And
start.
How do you pronounce your first name?
Oh, Tribad.
Oh.
Tribad.
Yeah, I don't like it. Okay. It's a vendor name.
So your former general secretary is very, he has pronounced it very well. Your former general secretary. DG or Tim?
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, my name is Tommy Lelama. I'm the Director General of the Department of Employment and Labor. So next to me is Ms. Mataboke. She has been my office.
Thank you, Master.
Next to me is the Commissioner of the Compensation Fund, Mr. William Mafata. There's a 50-50 split right behind me. Yeah, unfortunately. Scarab from the DM's office, it's PND from DM's office. It's Mr. Will from DM's office. It's Advocate Greggy from my office. Then I dispel it.
We have got two. There's a gentleman at the back, towards the communication. Her name, his name. Oh, I'm told. Oh, sorry. Oh, Swahili, communications officer for the portfolio committee. And you, lady, can you?
Haneem Davids from PMG.
No, thank you very much. We will, before the presentation, we'll allow the minister to open up and then.
I will just be short, Chairperson and members, Deputy Minister, DG, and the officials who are here. Of course, the media and other guests. Just first, Chairperson, the Cabinet has just an announcement, has concurred with the extension of the DG's term for another 5 years. Oh, so it has ended, so he still has the job. So, which means he's coming at the right time to put a plan about this year, which is going to be part of his performance contract, this issue of the compensation fund. Chairperson, just quickly, I believe that the CF is starting to move in the right direction, although perhaps not as rapidly as we would wish. The fundamental diagnostic and restructuring began in 2015-16 financial year. Well, now they are in phase two of the action plan, which began with the objective of strengthening the financial controls. That's where I'm saying to the Deputy Minister, we must focus on the financial controls before you can do anything, as guided by the AG. Because we've had a conversation with the AG. Lots of issues have been raised. And I guess the commissioner would speak to those areas of us focusing on the financial controls, the recruitment, the systems we're trying to put in place. But the critical IT issues are being addressed as we speak with the implementation of something new they call the Comp-Easy integrated system. But Chairperson, and I guess your own experience and the other members here, the elephant in the room in most of the departments has always been this issue of the IT system. You go to any department, you find problems upon this thing. And some of you would remember, we have been having problems for years with the CETA, to the extent that people end up looking for their own IT systems. You ask any department, you will hear the same problem. So this is a critical issue. But we believe that once we deal with the financial controls, with the IT system and the right personnel, those developments will greatly assist in addressing the past negative audit findings by the AG. But what is important now is that the ministry and this oversight body, the portfolio committee, must monitor the implementation of that action plan. And then it would be good, I'm not dictating terms to the portfolio committee, but it would be good that you get a report, even if it means bi-monthly, on the progress of the compensation fund. And clear timeframes or timelines on what I would call milestones. It can't be a turnaround for the sake of a turnaround. There must be clear milestones. And I think it would be good that the DG and the commissioner talk to that. And I hope that DG will also, as the last item from me, talk about the High Court judgment in relation to the UIF, compensation fund on domestic workers. Mm-hmm. It's important that the members are aware so that they are able to follow that as to what is happening. Just briefly, more of information sharing. But Chair, I just think that more will come from the presentation of the action plan. We must not waste any time. Of course, because I was in the cabinet, I will stay for some time and leave and go back to the cabinet. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Minister. I hope members have noted, can I say, the recommendation or the suggestion by the minister on moving forward. So when we are interacting with the presentation, I hope we won't forget about that, because I think it's very important. DG, can we hand over? I made a suggestion that we'll get the process, we'll get this report. Then the other one on the PPs will then come back. I hope by the time you finish, we will then be able to, we have received the copies, and then we'll then be able to direct members where we think that it's important for the committee to interact. All right, DG.
Thank you very much, Chair and honorable members. Chair, the minister has already indicated that the diagnostic review that we did in 2015 led us to the development of the what we call an action plan. We chose to call it an action plan rather than a turnaround strategy because we had turnaround strategies for a long time, and we failed to care. So we decided that we'd call it an action plan because it was conceived so that we can start acting on the challenges that we're experiencing. So what I'll do, Chair and the honourable members, I'll just reflect on the first action plan. What we intended to do with the first action plan, and then I'll ask the commissioner to take the committee through the second iteration of the action plan. We call it the action plan version 2, which is aimed at dealing with all the other outstanding matters from the first action plan. So the commissioner will deal with that. So the phase one action plan was implemented from July 2015 to April 2018 in order to stabilize the operations of the fund and put in place basic fundamentals. So the phase two of the action plan is now focused on building progress made and to, one, enhance the control environment within the fund that the minister referred to, and secondly, ensure that the fund delivers according to its mandate with high level of ethics. All projects and activities that were not completed during phase one have been incorporated into this action plan. It incorporates all witnesses identified from Auditor General reports, strategic and operational risk assessment processes, and service delivery improvement plans. What is it that we wanted to deal with when we did the diagnostic review of the compensation fund? The first problem that we picked up was the financial management issues. Poor quality of information used for financial reporting, inability to produce accurate monthly financial statements. And at this point, Chair, I want to state is that over a period of time, compensation fund could not produce financial statements at all. The inability to carry out some of the financial management functions on the financial system. The non-compliance to supply chain management policies and regulations resulting in high number of financial misconduct cases. High number of AGSA audit findings that have not been dealt with over a number of years. And inadequate capacity in the Chief Directorate financial management. The second issue that we wanted to deal with was an administrative issues. Poor communication within the fund, oversight committees highly involved in operational management of the fund. Here, when we talk about oversight, we're not referring to the portfolio committee, we're referring to the audit committee and advisory board, functional. Organized structure for management interaction were not fully functional. Consultants engaged with duplicated scope, in some cases, and no effective skills transfer. Inadequate ICT environment, thus contributing to poor systems deployment, poor record management processes. The third point that we wanted to deal with, Chair, is service delivery issues. Because we have inadequate ICT infrastructure, volumes of claims were unpaid. leading to legal challenges, infrequent payments of benefits, refusal by medical providers to assist our clients. This was a very difficult time, Chair, because workers would be sustain injuries at work, and some would contract occupational diseases, but the medical institutions would refuse to treat them because the compensation fund was not paying the institutions. The risk of over-reliance on ICT service provider for the claim system. Here we're referring to a licensee of the fund, which is the Rand Mutual Association, RMA. The lack of integration of the systems of the fund to allow for seamless reporting and monitoring of performance. So we're trying to run different systems so that we're not interfacing, which makes reporting very difficult. The fourth issue that we wanted to, continue from the service delivery issues, medical service providers would destabilize the fund system for their own advantage. Unregulated, undefined involvement of third parties in the claims process. We have a system there which is called, we have service providers who are able to switch claims. So you can go to them and say, take over these claims at a cost, so you will be paid, and then they will be the ones dealing with the compensation fund. That's what we're referring to, third parties. So they will then, these third parties will then claim on behalf of their doctors and other people, of course, at a cost to those people. So they then took advantage of the inefficiencies of the compensation fund and created a lucrative business. And some of them were stationed right inside the compensation fund. And that was the extent of the challenge that we set with. Claims data is still in three-year systems, e-claims, ICM, and Umetuva. That's the point I was raising, that we were running three separate systems and the systems were not interfacing, which made reporting very difficult. Limited medical professionals for assessment of medical claims. So we had staff that most of them were not familiar with the work that is done by the compensation fund, especially medical adjudication, claims. So that's one of the problems that we have. And at the time, all provincial offices were merely serving as post offices. So they will, if you have a claim in the Western Cape, the provincial office will collect all the claims and post them to head office for adjudication. And that was before we decided to decentralize the operations of the compensation fund. Inadequate training of the systems of the fund. The fourth issue is people issues. So we had low staff morale, unintended consequences of decentralization. So when we finally thought of decentralizing, the process that we followed was not correct. And so you sat with people who were not happy. You know, this whole process was not managed properly. Relations between staff and management were at an all-time low. Breakdown in relationship between organized labor and management. There was lack of trust in terms of how decentralization was done and all other issues. Silo operations among the different units in the fund. Lack of accountability with no consequences. Poor change management efforts for all transformation projects, including systems deployment. General unhappiness with salary levels in the organization and poor management of personal development plans. So, with the phase one action plan, having identified the key issues that we needed to address at the time, for financial management, customer focus and service delivery improvement, internal business processes. So we decided that we will have a number of initiatives that will cover this certain areas. And in total, we had 39 initiatives. And out of those 39 initiatives, there were 114 planned activities. Now, I want to take the committee through the achievements of the Phase 1 Action Plan so that the committee can have an appreciation of the difference between the compensation fund that we have now, plagued by the problems that it's plagued with, and the compensation fund that we had in 2014 before the implementation of the Action Plan. Well, the minister said that a number of steps have been taken and we've moved from where we are and to where we are now. And even though the pace of movement has not been as rapid as it was supposed to have been because of a number of challenges. So because of the interventions that we came up with, and earlier on I mentioned the failure by the fund not to be able to pay benefits. So with the interventions, and because also as part of the system that of the compensation fund, we were supposed to have paid discounts to employers. Because if you comply and you do whatever you are supposed to do, you're supposed to get rebates from the compensation fund. It's part of the strategy to encourage employers to comply. So 33,200 employers were paid discounts amounting to 211 million in March 2016. And this is the reason why some of the employers took us to court because of the fact that we were not doing what we're supposed to do. The correction of the interest and penalty system functionality resulting in 2.4 billion of incorrectly calculated interest corrected, resulting in improved and accurate debtors book. Thirdly, incidence of irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure has reduced significantly from 2015-16 financial year as a result of improved controls and policies. The figure itself in terms of the amount of money may not have gone down, but the incidences, the occurrences have definitely gone down. Disclaimers on bank reconciliation eliminated, which is a matter of emphasis, opinion on reconciling items, which those items are unallocated receipts, are now being dealt with. Allocation of receipts from employers done accurately as a result of improved referencing system and processes developed. All payments for benefits successfully migrated to SAP, where payments validation are done on the integrated customer database to ensure right creditors are paid. The finance team has been capacitated at a number of skilled professionals employed, which has resulted in improved financial reporting, reduction of the irregular expenditure, and reducing the overall audit findings. So we've now built the capacity of our finance division to be able to even now producing a financial management report, which in the past they have not been able to do that. They're now producing a financial report. And of course, the reduction of the regular expenditure and the overall audit findings. We implemented a chronic medication dispensing program. And this program is very, very important because we have patients that we provide chronic medication to. We've now developed a system where we even, they don't have to go to the hospitals or they don't have to go to the chemists. We deliver the medication to the patients.
restored relations with the stakeholders who participate in the claims value chain. This is one area that the commissioner and his team worked tirelessly to change. They've met with the service providers, they've assured service providers that this is a different compensation fund. It was a difficult task, but I must say that Chairperson and honorable members, that they pulled it, and they now are able to, the compensation fund clients, if you are injured at work, they are no longer being turned back by the medical institutions. They are now being serviced because we now pay service, the compensation fund now pays. In order to improve the quality of service to injured workers, the fund has employed medical personnel in provinces to deal with medical claims and case management functions. So part of the work that we did was to say, you can't deal with medical claims if you don't have medical background. Can't. You can't head medical services division if you don't have a medical background. So we've appointed medical practitioners throughout of the provinces. So now compensation fund in provinces is now headed by medical practitioners. And provinces are no longer post offices. They are fully fledged processing centers where claims are adjudicated, and the head office's responsibility is to pay. So we fully integrated the functions. So now, provinces now have medical services, disability management, and medical case coordination competences. Part of what we had to do, Chair, when we did the diagnosis, we realized that the structure of the compensation fund does not suit the functions that are supposed to be performed by the compensation fund. So we then said we needed to have three units that would be talking directly to the work of the compensation fund. One, the medical services unit, which will be dealing with medical related matters. Secondly, the compensation benefits. And thirdly, the disability and rehabilitation unit. So we've built that, and we've appointed people in those areas who are competent, and the work has now started. We are beginning to see the impact of the changes that we have made. So the fund has implemented a new legal case management system that will be able to assist in managing and monitoring litigation as well as the objection in terms of Section 91 cases. Fraud prevention policy and strategy developed and implemented. And one of the things that we do as we were restructuring the fund was to say, let's separate your normal risk management unit and have another unit that deals specifically with fraud and forensic investigations. So we have that unit which is separated, which operates separately from your risk management unit. So that's the unit that is able to uncover a number of the fraudulent activities that are taking place there. Skills audit performed and identified a number of skills and competency gaps in the fund. A number of interventions have been put in place to address skills gap identified. And these include bursary program in collaboration with the Tutuka Bursary Scheme and the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants to train medical doctors, nurses, occupational therapists, actuaries, and chartered accountants. Because we are in the medical and insurance environment, and CF operates in the public service environment, we compete with the Department of Health, Discovery, and all other medical things. So, at the salaries that we're offering as a public service, so we're finding it very difficult to get the, you know, the competences that we require as a fund. So that's why we took a decision that let's train young people in these areas where we require skills, so that we can absorb these young people in the compensation fund. In the event that we're unable to absorb them, we would have contributed to the skills, skills revolution in the country, and they could work anywhere. So the fund has completed a review. Has completed a review of its functional structure, which has resulted in the restructuring of the core functions of the fund, the point that I mentioned earlier on. The redesigned organizational structure provides clear accountability and supporting lines for improved service delivery and clear business processes. So this is the work that we did, which was informed by the phase one action plan. And that action plan brought us to where we are with regards to the operations of the fund. We're now happy that on a monthly basis we're able to pay claims, we're able to adjudicate claims. And if there are new claims that are submitted to the fund, we're able to adjudicate those claims. And it is as a result of the hard work that the commissioner and his staff has put to make sure that at least the fund does what it's supposed to do, which was something that was not happening in the past. So I'll ask the commissioner to move to the second iteration of the action plan.
Thank you, Chairperson. The moving from phase one or the first phase of the action plan to the second phase, we looked at what are the things that we need to do then to improve. Now that we've stabilized the operations of the fund and we're starting to perform the work that we expected to do in terms of our mandate, what are the things that we then need to do to accelerate the pace and also improve the general controls in the organization, as well as making sure that we address a lot of the gaps that have been identified by the various assurance providers, the Auditor General, internal audit, and so on. So the problems of the fund are like, we always liken them to, you know, we have a house with a leaking pipe. So previous efforts over years in the compensation fund to try and address the problems have always been about how do we then mop up the water that is leaking, yet we leave the pipe still leaking. So you mop up and you mop up, but the water still comes out of the pipe. So the approach we took with the action plans was, how do we then make sure that the first phase was how do we seal the pipe, and the second phase is then how do we replace the pipe, so that once the pipe is replaced, there's no leaking water. You're able to actually clear out the water and make sure that there's no water anymore in the house. So that's the approach that we've taken. So now the objectives of this action plan was, one, to improve the systems of internal control within the fund, improve service delivery to all our stakeholders, address the poor organizational culture of performance of the fund, eliminate occurrences of fraud and corruption, as well as develop capacity for the fund to be able to deliver on its mandate. Like the previous action plan, go to the next slide. The action plan was anchored on four pillars. One was the financial management and governance pillar. The second one was service delivery and performance improvement. The third pillar was anti-corruption and integrity management, and lastly was an organizational culture renewal and capacity building. So the activities that we have in the action plan are all anchored on these four pillars. We have about 162 action plans in this action plan or action steps, and we then had different stage gates at which we would then assess the impact of all these activities that we would have developed across the four different pillars. What this slide shows us, for example, at the end of July 2019, we may not get out of the claim because of the systemic issues that we are dealing with to try and replace this pipe. But we want to make sure that at least the number of issues that affect the audit report are reduced. And we actually succeeded in reducing these findings. We had just above 100 audit findings that span across the different operations of the fund. And this was a huge reduction from the previous years when we had in excess of 150 plus audit matters that would affect the audit report. And then we have a plan in terms of how do we move from there to eventually getting an unqualified audit once we've dealt with a lot of the issues by end of July 2022. In the next slide, it just shows then that a large weight of all these activities are the things that we want to do, because we want to see the immediate impact while we're trying to address a lot of the other issues. So a large number of the activities that we have are in the first part of the action plan. We divided it into a short-term date as well as the medium-term date, which is ending at 2021, and the long-term dates, which are ending at 2022. About 162 of these, are 84% of these, are in the short term. So what we'd have, for example, in the financial management pillar, we have in total about 15 outputs that we deliver against. And out of these 15 outputs in financial management, about 45 action plans aimed at addressing specific issues that I will touch on later. With regard to the second pillar of service delivery and performance improvements, it's about 31 outputs. We should have about 74 action plans in the short term. And on the anti-corruption integrity management, about 10 outputs with 18 specific actions. And on organizational culture renewal and capacity building, about 11 with 25 activities. And then the number reduces in the subsequent year. A large number of the issues that we will be doing in the subsequent years are those issues related to major system development, changing the policy environment to address some of the inefficiencies that are as a result of the legislation that we are performing, that we are responsible for performing, to make sure that we reduce some of the inefficiencies that are created by these bottlenecks created by legislation. In the next slide, then it shows in total the number of outputs, 67, and the total action plans over those three terms, short, medium, and long. It's about 192 action steps with the 67 outputs. When we go to the first output, or the first pillar, which is the financial management and governance. So here it comprises all the activities that are aimed at addressing the control weaknesses that would have been identified through the risk assessments, internal audits, as well as the auditor general. I must say though that a lot of the issues that relate to financial administration and management are not necessarily the issues that are in finance, because the work that we do in operations, but all the things we do in operations end up in the financial statements. We process a claim, we pay a claim, then it becomes a financial transaction that is reported in the financial statement. So in addressing the issues, we address the issues on the operation side itself, which will then translate into the impact on the financial management side. So in the next slide, we have number of outputs, and we look at a number of these things. One, we needed to improve financial and performance reporting. And here these are activities that are related to how do we then do reconciliations, how do we prepare financial statements, what type of performance audits we need to do on a regular basis to address the issues of accurate and completeness of reporting of financial statements. We also had here to revise the employer assessment model that we needed to implement. We previously reported to the committee that the revenue of the fund is generated through the employers that we register. Now, the way that we assess the employers is that when an employer registers for the compensation fund, you can fall in any one of the 102 different risk classes. So if you operate in riskier classes, you fall in riskier industries, you fall within a specific class. And each of that class has its own rate that they pay. Unlike where, if you know with the URF, you pay 1% of the salary, the employer pays 1%. With the compensation fund, there's 102 different rates that an employer is offering. Part of the issue that the auditor general has raised with the disclaimer on our revenue is that a lot of the employers aren't registered in the correct classes that they should be in. So we have employers that may be registered in a incorrect class, resulting in them paying less than what they ought to have paid, or registered in an incorrect class, paying more than what they ought to be paid. So, and this is as a result of, could be a number of things. Could be the misrepresentation by employers. Number two could also be collusion between the employers and our internal staff in making sure that an employer gets registered in a class that may result in him or her paying a lesser rate. And the problem could also be at registration when the employer is registered the first time. The employer is not registered correctly because he did not, he was vague in his description of what his business activities are. So these are the things that were causing a lot of the disclaimer. And also those are some of the things that caused a lot of customer complaints, because we have a lot of employers coming, because what you would find in situations where clever accountants and consultants would tell an employer, I can help you get a refund from the compensation fund for in exchange for a portion of the refund that you're getting. And how they would then want to facilitate this refund would be to come to the fund and say, this employer was incorrectly registered. This employer actually belongs in this class. So, and it has been like that since registration. If the registration has been since 1970, they will say, since 1970, we've been incorrectly billing. So then there would be those fights in courts where we would then refuse to reclassify the employer and so on. So what we wanted to do was to simplify this model so that it addresses the service delivery issues as well as addressing these audit issues. So we then said we'll revise this assessment model. It is a process that is currently at NEDLEC. I'll talk about it later on when I talk about the progress on this. So we are now revising this so that we can reduce this from 102 to 16, which becomes a bit more manageable, and it broadens the categories so that you don't find any room for creativity by employers or by these consultants to have a person. And part of this is how we can then also, because a few years ago we started discussions with SARS to try and get how SARS can help us with the collections and so on. But what we needed to do was to simplify our model so that it enables it to be able to, for SARS to be able to collect on it. So that's one of the reasons why we also changing the assessment model. We also needed to improve the audit management functions in the fund. A lot of the things that we have found was that a lot of the issues that we find that ends up in the audit report has been as a result of abdication of responsibilities by management, or sometimes even lack of understanding of the audit process itself. So we put in a lot of activities to make sure that we improve the way that we manage our interactions with Auditor General and how we then send information for audit and receive information for audit. We also needed to improve the debt collection functions of the fund, the accounting processes for revenue, the number of issues, some of the issues that the AG raised with regards to our disclaimers on revenue was on the way that we account for our revenue as a result of the way that the legislation is designed. We improved controls and accuracy of our accounts payable information. This is a lot of work that we're doing on the claim side, improving compliance to legislation. One of the things also is improved systems for debt collection. There's a lot of activities in the plan that relates to how we're going to improve the debt collection functions of the fund. Part of it includes resuscitating the debt collection system that we have in our system in SAP. The improved systems for accounting for claims and pensions. This is the work that we're doing now currently with the new computer system, improved integration between claims and finance systems, improved knowledge and awareness of accounting standards. Part of the issue was because we had people with no skills. We brought in a lot of skills in the organization, but we still had a lot of junior officials that we needed to train and upskill so that they can understand the functions that they are performing and what is the impact on the financial statement. So we've had a lot of capacity building programs for the junior officials that are working in finance that may have been there but didn't possess the necessary qualifications that are needed to operate in there. We then also continue to improve the capacity of financial management in the fund. There has been also some interventions that the minister has requested us to look at to further strengthen the capacity of financial management, and some of those things that we are looking at. So now, these are the outputs that we had, and there's a lot of activities that we highlighted. If you look at slide 22, a lot of those activities are that we have, action steps that we have to try and address these outputs that we've highlighted above. We improve controls in the management of the general ledger activities, reconciliations that needs to be completed. The DG spoke about the fact that when we started the transformation journey, financial statements weren't being produced in the compensation fund. Now, one of the things that we're doing is that we're performing proper reconciliations to determine completeness and accuracy of financial information so that when we produce financial statements, the information is accurate, improve controls in the management of the general daily activities, the implementation of the revised assessment model. I spoke about the improvement in the audit management, so there has been some activities that we put in place to ensure that the work that we do with the AG is controlled. Part of the audit issues that we have was also because of the lack of understanding sometimes of the complex environment that, or complex operations that the compensation fund manages. So the development of standard operating procedures and workshops in some of those, for example, at the beginning of every audit session cycle, we do have workshops with the AG where we take them through the standard operating procedures and what has changed from last year so that they understand what they audit, what is the environment that they are auditing. The review of policies, among those policies was the unallocated receipts, so that we reduce the amount of time it takes for us to wait for an employer where he has paid using an incorrect reference number, that money doesn't get allocated. So we're trying to reduce the time frame because those are some of the issues that relate to revenue disclaimer. Applying to the state attorney to get exemption so that we can get the service provider for debt collection. There is provisions in the COIT legislation that allows the commissioner to be able to over and above the enforcement mechanisms that we use through the department's inspectorate. There's provisions in the law that says that the commissioner may issue civil civil proceedings against any non-complying employer. But to do that, you also, there's a legal process that needs to be followed, and the Office of the State Attorney is not capacitated well to be able to assist us with this. So some of the work that we're currently doing now is we are now looking at how we can then get this outsourced to make sure that we can then effectively use that over and above to augment the work that is being done by the inspectorate to enforce compliance. We also said one of the things that we needed to do was to finalize the recovery of the advance payments that were made in 2012. One of the issues that is in the public protector's report, as well as in the issues that were being investigated by the SIU. And we said one of the things that we need to do is we need to make sure as part of this action plan we finalize the recovery of those monies that were paid out in advance and close that chapter. Developing processes to deal with the return of earnings, including the accounting processes that have been found to be at fault by the AG related to return of earnings. Also, we DG spoke about stakeholder relations that we've done over the last few years. We continue to do those things to make sure that we pay accurately the amount of money that we need to pay to service provider. We've also done, also targeted to have system enhancements to allow for splits of payments between pensions and concerned attendant allowance. One of the issues that the AG had raised with regard to the inaccuracies of our claim is in the way that the systems were configured and the way that we were reporting on our benefits that we pay. We also needed to, one of the big action items here was also to procure and configure a new claims management system that would then meet the requirements of the fund. Introducing the verification of information so that one of the issues that we've had long-standing issues with the AG on is that we introduced online services in 2014. So now with online services, you don't expect a doctor or an employer to send you physical documents. You want a doctor to be able to, as soon as they've treated a client, they go into our system and then type in their medical report and say, this is what the issue is, so that we can fast track the issue, the payment of the claim. An employer also, when a person is injured, we don't want them now to be completing papers and then sending papers to the hospital and paper to us. We then introduce that electronic platform for them to be able to capture all those into the system. And this has been an issue with the AG because they're saying that we don't have a way of verifying if the information that the doctor is capturing or that the employer is capturing is correct. So that's one of the reasons why they also then gave a disclaimer on benefits. Despite our argument that that's the reason why you go online, because you want everyone to be able to capture what they capture and make it easier for service delivery. So how we've then dealt, because that's the issue that the AG was saying, but then you have a responsibility to be able to then verify each of this information. We process about 950 million medical invoices annually, about 160,000 claims annually. So the expectation is that we need to then verify 160,000 claims over and above. So, and the process was, in the past, the reason why we had such slow processing of claims was because we had paper. So we still have to now go through paper and capture the paper. So So what the AG wants is now to say the employer must submit it electronically, but you must still go look for the paper. You must still look through the paper. So that's going to double the amount of effort that you need to do. So, but to address the, and we understand the control gaps that the AG was raising, because he was saying that an employer can give you anything, and you just accept it. So what we've done in the new claims management system that we just developed now, is the employer will still capture that information, but they must attach the reports and everything else so that we can then go back and verify the information that you get. So that will then address the concerns of the Auditor General, but it also then addresses our issues of wanting to be able to speed up the process of processing and paying claims. We have also said we will clean up the irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. A large number of the items that the AG has reported on irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, a lot of the activities that we have taken place all the way back to 2008, 2004, and so on. So we needed to start a process to be able to how can we then deal with those things and clear them off the books of the fund. Because here we successfully closed the leaking pipe because we improved the supply chain management environment in the fund. New policies, we brought in skilled personnel in supply chain to be able to help manage the way that we do our procurement. But then we still have this water that we need to mop up, and this water that we need to mop up is these cases of irregular expenditure that the AG keeps reporting on. Then we said we need to deal with this so that where we need to recover the money, we can recover the money. Where we need to write off or condone, where we need to apply consequence punishment, that also can then be done. We also said we needed to implement a bank verification system for the fund. Part of the problems we have with fraudulent claims is that sometimes you process the right claim to the right person, but the payment goes to the wrong person because either someone is intercepting the payment when it goes to the bank and so on. So we needed to implement a bank verification system that would allow us to be able to make sure that we verify how we pay, that the person that whose claim we approved is exactly the same person that you pay. The money that only lends into the bank account, it lends in the correct bank account. So there is a bank verification process that we started as well. And also the issues around the role matrix in the system. We said we wanted to build a debt collection solution within our SAP environment that we use for financial management. Developed a system for reports on claims to identify other claims where we need to claim from third parties that are related to the fund, because that's one of the issues that has been raised by the AG that contributes to the inaccurate benefits that we report, because the expectation is that if a person gets injured and it's not a motor vehicle accident, if I get injured in the workplace, but it's a motor vehicle accident, you have a claim with the road accident fund, you have a claim with us. The process is that we both have to adjudicate the claim, but the road accident fund would have to wait for us to finalize our claims process, because their payment is much higher than what we pay. So once we finalize, they then approve the person's claim minus the amount of money that we paid, and then they would then reimburse us for the money that we paid for the client. This is to make sure that the person doesn't double dip from government, getting benefits on both sides. So one of the things that we had is that our current system was not enabling us to be able to differentiate between those claims and normal claims. So that led to inaccurate claims that we then report on our financial statements. We also needed to investigate the efficiencies in the Umesuba system at the time, because the DG spoke about the different systems that we're using to process and pay claims. So this resulted in inefficiencies, in some of the cases, inaccuracies in the way that we pay some of the claims. We also needed to train personnel on GRAPS, which is generally recognized accounting practices, and related principles for all the finance personnel that required upgrading of skills as a result of the outcome of the skills audit that was done in the first phase of the action plan. And also review and capacitate the internal control structure. This is the unit that then manages the control, the internal control environment of the fund, and making sure that there's controls in everything that we do. So we've also established that unit as part of the restructuring that we did in the compensation fund. The second pillar is the service delivery and performance improvement. Here, this comprises of all the activities that are aimed at addressing service delivery challenges that we experienced in the fund. And we actually then divided into about three categories. We focus on the customer care issues, the employer services issues which relate to employers and how they pay and how they submit the assessment, and then lastly also on the compensation as well as the medical benefits of the fund. The output that we had in customer care was one, was look at ways how we can improve access to CF services, improve the client and stakeholder relations in the organization. The DG spoke about the work that we've been doing to try and improve the relations between ourselves and our stakeholders. And also use technology that we can adopt to improve the customer service, deal with the employee morale issues within the customer care environment, and also improve the capacity of the call center of the compensation fund to make sure that we address a lot of the complaints that we receive from clients regarding the operations of our call center. So in order to address a number of these issues on the customer care side, one of the things that we needed to do, because people would say, we call the call center, but we then have to wait for a long time to get responses and to get an answer for a simple thing that we're trying to understand. Or sometimes it takes a number of days to go to back office for it to be resolved. So one of the things that we said was to be able to make sure that our customer care or call center agents have the answers first time when the person calls. We needed to develop a database of frequently asked questions with the responses, and then we automate those so that if a person asks a question phone in the call center, they can then just go into the system and look for a response onto the system with regard to a specific matter. And also to try and address, because we have key groupings of stakeholders that represent the interest of the people that we serve. We have employers who would have their also their stakeholder groupings that represent their interests, organized business formations and so on. We've got the workers that are also represented by organized labor, and we have medical practitioners as well who also have their own formations. And one of the things that we realized that we did wrong, one of the things that was that we were far from our stakeholders. We were the compensation fund, we were swimming and drowning in our own problems, when some of the solutions were lying in the, some of the stakeholders that could help us to try and address some of these issues that we had. So we had a strategy then to say we're going to develop a key account management process where we can assign a number of our clients, of our call center agents that would then be responsible for dealing with specific stakeholders as well as part of the stakeholder management. So we then were going to introduce the key account manager so that they can be able to then deal effectively and make sure that when certain complaints come through some of the stakeholder groupings or people who are members of the stakeholder groupings, there is a dedicated team that deals with these issues. We automate the work of the call center, because up until now it has been manual. Through the introduction of a CRM tool, the client relations management tool, oftentimes when we phone a call center in the private sector, you can phone a few days later. They still have a record of when you called and what is it that you were doing and who you spoke to. So those are some of the functionalities that we didn't have because we didn't have technology in our call center. So we're now in the process of deploying a client relations management tool that will also help us to achieve the very same purpose, so that people don't have to call over and over again and restate their stories. We can then have a record of what is there. One of the issues that we picked up when we did the climate survey was that in as much as there's a lot of there's pockets where we're not doing well, there's pockets where we're doing well, but a lot of that performance wasn't recognized, and as a result it was not doing enough to be able to help change the environment in the fund so that people can learn from each other. So we also looked at the issues around service excellence awards that we can implement as part of the tools to motivate those that are performing well and to also inspire those that are not to be able to aspire to something. We also needed to develop a knowledge management strategy and policy for the fund. One of the things that we found was that compensation fund is a complex environment. A lot of the knowledge sits with people. That's why we find a lot of people, when they leave the compensation fund, be it whether they retire or they go on pension, the very same people that go and work for third parties, consultants and so on, that are interacting with the fund, because they have all the knowledge and the processes and how these things happen. And sometimes when they leave a vacuum and a void in the compensation fund, because the knowledge lives with them. So we then also said we're going to develop a knowledge management strategy and policy that will then help us to know how we can keep and retain the knowledge. With the claims management system that we just implemented now, we've actually been able to achieve that everything that we do in the system automatically gets reduced to a training manual. As long as it's configured in the system, there's an automatic training manual that is there that anyone can access. So if I input it into the functionality in the system, all that knowledge sits in the system and can be used for training. So that's one of the ways that we then make sure that we then retain this knowledge in the organization. We also needed to do business process re-engineering and query resolution processes. One of the things we also then developed standards, service standards, to say if a person inquires and this is the service that they need, this is how many days that they need to be assisted. Beyond that, then it means we have reached the standard that we've set for ourselves to address a service delivery issue. One of the outputs was about increasing accessibility of the compensation fund. So one of the things that we're doing was also here to procure mobile buses and clinics that we can then use to increase our access to clients. Because a lot of our clients, some of them will be in rural areas and so on. We may not have labor centers, even if we have labor centers in those areas. Some of the people that are injured with wheelchairs or prosthetic limbs and so on, to expect them to then travel a couple of kilometers or get into a taxi to go to a labor center if they need the services of the compensation fund. Some of these things were not practical. So we now started the process to want to get the mobile clinics and the mobile buses that we then use as administrating centers so that we can then go out to where the clients are. And we found, for example, with a program that the DG is running now on taking services to the people, when we go to our clients on the ground, we find a lot of the clients live in rural areas where they would not have easy access to even public transport itself. So that's why we're trying to get these mobile buses up and running as well. Because we are also automating our process and introducing online functions, we also don't take it for granted that a lot of the employers don't have access to the internet, even some of the employees, to be able to check the status of their claims. So we also then rolling out kiosks in our labor centers where they can be internet terminal. So a person can walk into a Department of Labor office, go to an internet terminal and be able to either register his claim or check the status of his claim. If it's an employer, they can then also register online while they're there. They don't have to be waiting for us to do the registration for them. And then also one of the issues also that leads to poor service delivery is also the fact that not a lot of people understand the processes of the compensation fund or even know their rights to access the benefits of the compensation fund. So that's why we find people who have been injured for years and the people never came forward to claim, or they know that the employer submitted a claim but they've never followed up or anything else because they don't know what is it that they have access to. So we then also said we needed to we communicate more booklets and so on. You may have seen that the compensation fund has been quite visible in the media and everywhere else, telling people about the work that we do and what benefits they have access to when they get injured in the workplace. On the second part of service delivery was on the employer services side, which is where we deal with employers. One of the things that the output that we had targeted there was to business processes and procedures for employer services, because a lot of this is one area where the big problem that I spoke about of knowledge management resided, where a lot of the knowledge sits with people and it's not documented, was not documented anywhere. And also the other issue that we're trying to address here is the issues around compliance to legislation, enrich the employer data, because this is one of the reasons why the AG said that there's doubts around the completeness and accuracy of our revenue. Automate some of the functions that we have, because a lot of the functions that we have in employer services were manual. When you needed to register for the compensation fund, you needed to complete paper, send it to the compensation fund, and wait for 60 days to get your registration number out. We also then needed to enhance the capacity of the ICT infrastructure in employer services to make sure that we have automated systems. We also wanted to implement an electronic filing process for employers to be able to submit their return of earnings electronically as opposed to submitting them manually, and then improve capacity in that unit. The activities that we have that were supporting this, or that were aimed at achieving these outputs, one was we wanted to have an integrated and automated system for both claims and revenue management. The first phase of this project was the claims management solution. We've now just rolled out our claims system. Now the second phase is now how to get the revenue or the premium collection part into the system, then we'll achieve this integrated automated system for both claims and revenue. We also, because of the creativity of accountants and consultants, as well as the fact that employers would not know what their obligations are when there's an incident in the workplace, when they need to register, when they need to submit return of earnings, because a lot of the things would be documents that we have internally that we then communicate to employers whenever they inquire. But we then said we're going to issue these as notices, publish these regulations, so that everyone knows what is expected of you as an employer to comply with the legislation. The control weaknesses that have been identified, some of them were issues around segregation of duties in employer services. We also then looked at how we can then enhance the system to be able to achieve some of these weaknesses that had been raised. We partnered with the inspection and enforcement services for them to enhance the collection and the compliance levels of the fund. We signed an MOU in 2016, and part of it has resulted in the creation of dedicated payroll auditors that are auditing COIT compliance, and also the work that the inspectors in general do to help enforce compliance to COIT legislation. We also needed to automate a lot of the functions of employer services to make sure that employers don't have to come to our offices, but they can do whatever they need to do in their offices. This included the CF filing that we implemented in 2018, as well as the payroll auditor that I spoke about. On the compensation benefit side, and on the medical benefits and rehabilitation, there's a number of outputs that we wanted to achieve. One was the issues around the business processes and procedures that we needed to develop. Case management that we needed to implement to make sure that those that are injured in the workplace, they get the right medical attention from the beginning. We don't wait until it's too late for people to get the treatment that they need. We also looked at how we can then introduce return to work and rehabilitation policy to make sure that those that get injured in the workplace can have the ability to get back into the labor market. They do get back into the labor market. The enhancing the interfaces that we have with some of the critical databases, some of the control weaknesses is the fact that we were not able to validate, even if a doctor registers with us and pays, we may be able to validate with Health Professions Council whether he's in right standing with the Board of Health Funders, which is required in terms of the Medical Schemes Act. All those other interfaces we didn't have, interfaces with Home Affairs and so on. So these are the interfaces that we then needed to build into our system to know if a pensioner is still alive or a pensioner is not alive anymore, to know whether we should continue paying pension or not. We also needed to deal with all the outstanding claims and make sure that those that are outstanding are cleared, improve the relations with our stakeholders, enhance a lot of the functionality that we had. While we are building the new claims management system, we also needed to enhance some of the functionalities on the systems that we were using at the time, which was Umesuko, to make sure that even though there's inefficiencies, the clients don't feel the inefficiencies, that we're able to still continue to deliver the service the way that is expected. And lastly, also to improve the capacity in our core business units. The DG spoke about the restructuring that we did, creating those three core business units. We need to make sure that once we've created those three core business units, each of these units is adequately capacitated to be able to deliver on their responsibilities. So in order to achieve these outputs, a number of action steps are being implemented to address this output. One was to develop processes for dealing with the staging areas with clear responsibilities. We spoke about the two systems, one for claims and one for revenue. The integration process results in a lot of items being sitting in the staging area if they're not able to be integrated between the financial system as well as the claim system. So we needed to develop clear processes to make sure that no client remains unpaid. If there's any doubts to his or her payments, those things are managed so that the payment is eventually paid. We also issue a lot of, as part of the way to improve the way that we process benefits, we pick up a lot of new things every now and then, new illnesses, new diseases that may be occupationally contracted or that people may sustain in the workplace. We then need to be able to make sure that we issue clear regulations and instructions on how those are to be adjudicated and paid. A lot of these over the years were developed and issued as a circular for implementation. So if we've made a decision on a claim and someone is not happy with it, we go to court, a lot of these circulars would not have any legal standing in court because they are not regulated. So we then said we need to look at all these instructions and use them as and regulate those so that they can then be gazetted and be able to have a legal standing when they are used either by ourselves or medical practitioners or by the employers themselves for registering and adjudicating claims. One of the issues that the AG had raised also was that for the website, because we've introduced online services, even the medical practitioners, when they submit our invoices, they no longer have to go through that frustration of having to, when they submit, when they've treated clients to medical aids, they have a way that they submit claims, which is electronic. To us, it was a manual process where they still needed to complete a paper and so on. So part of the things that we did when we introduced online services was to say, we want the doctor to be able to do the job once. If he's going to submit his invoices in a certain way to medical aid, he must just then submit it in the same way that they submitted to us. We introduced a concept of switching, where they can then submit electronic files to us. So in this case, they use then third parties to be able to submit these things on their behalf. The argument that the AG was raising was that, how do you then know that this the switching house submits the invoice on behalf of the doctor, and once the invoice is in our system, we pay the doctor. So one of the issues that the AG was raising was, but how then do you know that the switching house has been employed by the doctor? When we use the argument that, but we do pay the doctor, we don't pay the switching house, so we cannot say to a doctor who he must use or he must not use. So there's no approval process required on our side for a doctor, for a hospital to use a certain switch. But they highlighted a number of control weaknesses in that process, and they wanted us to be able to control how these people get to submit things into our system. So we then said we need to look at a vetting process of how, before we can allow any switching house to submit invoices on behalf of a doctor, they would then need to meet a certain criteria. If they meet it, then they can switch on behalf of a doctor. So those are the controls that we needed to implement. We also said we were to pilot a project for rehabilitation and return to work, so that we can see how we can then help with the vocational rehabilitation of our clients that injured in the workplace. We also needed to, I spoke earlier on about the new illnesses and diseases sometimes that come into the occupational space that we then need to account to cater for in our adjudication of claims. Post-traumatic stress disorder is one of them, which was a big issue that we had, especially with claims from Department of Correctional Services, SAPS, where a lot of claims were coming in, which is a new concept that was never catered for in the schedule of diseases that we have in COIA. So we then needed to develop a policy and processes, because otherwise it would be subject to abuse. Any person could say, I have post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of the work that I did, so I deserve to be declared 100% disabled and get a payout from the compensation fund and a monthly pension. So we then needed to implement a policy with control. So that was activity that we needed to do, to draft and publish a post-traumatic stress disorder policy that could then be used for adjudication of claims. We needed to deal with the develop and implement a claims management solution that I spoke about earlier. Also to be able to have ability to get reports that we can use so that we can identify a lot of exceptions that are also always picked up by the AG, and we're able to investigate and clear those prior to the time where we're required to develop financial statements for the fund. One of the issues also that leads to a lot of practitioners and employers outsourcing the work that they need to do on COIA is because they're saying that our law is so complex and they don't understand it. So one of the things that we wanted to do is to see how we can start engaging with institutions of higher learning. So that, you know, if a nurse goes and does an occupational health diploma, for example, that there should be a module that exclusively deals with COIA, so they understand, because those are the people that would effectively be dealing with people who are going to be injured in the workplace. If a person goes and does, you have a lot of practice managers that do these practice management courses that work on behalf of doctors, to look at how we can then get those to also, because the large work of the large part of what they do is also related to them helping the doctors to administer their quite claims. So we're also looking at how we can then develop material that can then be used for for that purpose. That would help clear the misunderstanding on COIDA, and it would also help to reduce the reliance that a lot of employers and doctors have on third parties for the work that they do, because often they have to do that at a cost. The one of the things that we also needed to do was to review the gazette that we have, our medical tariff. So the doctors, the way that they did that, is that annually the minister publishes the tariffs that we will pay for the medical treatment that clients of COIDA are going to be subjected to. And when the doctor has treated the client, they can only bill us based on those tariffs that we've gazetted. We cannot bill us outside that. So, and these are gazettes that have been developed over years. There is a need for us to modernize a lot of the gazettes and to also improve and change the way that some of these are done to align them with the best practice in the current medical aid environment. So that's one of the activities that we have in the action plan. One of the things that we have, which was one of the big projects, you may have seen the adverts towards the beginning of the year, middle of the year actually, where we had also this request for information program. We found that a lot of the clients that complained that they don't have, their claims have not been paid, or that they got injured in the workplace, and but the claims was never registered. When we trace a lot of these, when they come to us, we find that the claim sometimes was registered, but the process was never completed. Either the employer notified us of the incident, the person did get the first treatment that they needed in the hospital, but there was never a medical report that was submitted for us to be able to even adjudicate on the claim, or subsequent medical reports that were needed to actually finalize the claim were never submitted. So a person might have been treated, he's fine, he's well now, goes back to work, and the claim doesn't get finalized and so on. So what we did is, when we realized that a lot of these claims have the same common trend, that claim you may be in the system but never completed because of that information. So we did a request for information. We actually did two. One was during the first phase of the action plan. We also did one also now as part of this action plan. So we said to people, if you have a claim or anything else, just come forward. If you ever registered a claim, even if it was never registered, so that we can then see what happened with your claim. And if we need that to help you to get medical reports, because we do have provisions in the law, that if the medical reports were never issued by the medical practitioner, we can send you to a doctor at our cost so that we can get the medical report and help you to finalize your claim for that. So we actually did that. That the first time we did that, we didn't have a good response from clients at all. We, with the second phase that we did now, there was a large number of responses we received. We actually, that call closed now at the end of September. We're processing through the information that we received, because a lot of it sometimes does not relate to claims, so that we know who are the people that need to be helped, so that we can then finalize a lot of this work. We also realize that we also paying pensions, but we don't know who our pensioners are. We don't know who our pensioners are, in the sense that the people have been paid benefits, we now get paying them pensions, but we don't know what is the state of their health, we don't know what is the state of the social well-being. Does the person have children? Are the children going to school? Can they afford with the pension to be able to send children to school? So we then said we needed to build a database that would help us to start collecting this information. You may have heard on the radios over the last few weeks where we've been advertising some of the bursary programs we've developed for the children of these pensioners, so that they can come forward. If we had an electronic database of the pensioners and who their beneficiaries are, it would have been easy. We can just send the information to them and say, we've got these bursary programs, get your children to apply. But then we have to go out and call for these pensioners to come forward. We have on our books now about 27,000 pensioners. So we needed to then, there's a work that we're doing as part of the new system to develop this big database of these pensioners, so that we can get all this information about them. And we can know that this is a pensioner, he's got children who are in grade 12, they'll be going to varsity next year. We need to know how we can help them to get funding to be able to go to university the following year. So that's the, and also if there's any social assistance that the family needs in total as part of our rehabilitation process, how do we then get the family to be socially rehabilitated and assisted? We also said we needed to develop an online training for towns for training of staff on COIDA. This is one of the things that we've also achieved with the new claims management solution that we've developed. appointing security personnel, enhance the system so that we can have adequate audit trails. One of the control weaknesses that were raised by the AG was that sometimes information disappears on the system or changes on the system, but you don't have an audit trail of who made what changes, when were these changes made. Those are some of the control weaknesses that we had in the previous system that we're trying to address now with this new system that we've just rolled out. Anti-corruption, yes, basically it's activities that were aimed at also addressing the weaknesses and their behavioral attitudes that leads to fraud and corruption. Here's one of the things that we did. The DG spoke about the work that we did to split the risk management function from the anti-corruption and integrity management unit. So we split this as two units, and this unit focuses on two things. Where there's been incidents of fraud and corruption reported, they investigate those, but they also have another unit that is aimed at preventing and incidents of fraud, and the prevention includes working with staff, how we can then change behavior of staff and also try and change the way that staff sometimes subject themselves to being influenced by external parties to be able to commit incidents of fraud and corruption. So the outputs that we have here: maintain ethical culture, effective management of conflict of interest. We needed to look at a number of things that we can do to try and help to make sure that we prevent incidents of fraud and corruption from occurring, the effective management of our suppliers' database, training and awareness on fraud issues, improved stakeholder relations with the different financial institutions, because a lot of the money that we pay ends up in banks and so on. So we needed to make sure that all the regulators in the space, we have relations with them, and so that we can deal effectively with some of these things. Effective management of conflict of interest, as I said. So a lot of the outputs that we have in this particular pillar was one, to establish the ethics office and appoint an ethics officer that would then deal with all the issues of ethics, conduct the ethics assessment, and develop the SOPs for incidents. We have a lot of medical practitioners who from time to time would be also to maintain the license and so on, they would want to do administrative work outside where they can do clinical work, because the work that they do is more administrative. So we needed to make sure that we have a control process for those kind of things. The issues around the anti-corruption and anti-fraud strategy that needed to be developed, establishing relations with the Banking Risk Information Center, the Financial Intelligence Center, and so on. So those are the things that we wanted to do. Introduce also the concept of data analytics, especially in those areas that are susceptible to fraud and medical claims, the assessment of employers, and also the one of the things that we needed to do was also introduce prevention of fraud and corruption as a key performance indicator in performance agreements of everyone in the fund, to make sure that at least everyone has a role to play in making sure that we prevent incidents of corruption and fraud. In order to develop, to achieve these outputs, a number of things that we needed to do. One was the organization structure that needed to be fully implemented after the split that we did, to create now a standalone anti-corruption and integrity management unit, review the document, the processes and procedures that needed to be followed, as this was a new unit that was established. We needed to look at the activities. We need to look at the activities that would help us to get to an improved organizational culture in the organization, the way that we manage the records, the leave management, online training portal that we needed to implement to be able to deal with the some of these issues that are aimed at addressing our capacity, and also look at the activities that are aimed at improving the staff morale in the organization, because the work that we do through people that have been appointed in the fund. So some of these action steps related to this particular output was, we needed to finalize the placement of staff in the new organizational structure that we just developed, to make sure that everyone is sitting in the right boxes and they start to work and do the work that they've been appointed to do. We also wanted to review the structures that we had in the provinces so that we can align it to the recently restructured operations in the head office. We then also to address the issues that came out of the skills audit that we have done. We also then started the process to try and develop minimum qualification requirements for each post in the or each area in the fund, so that whenever we should post and we send people for training, we train people in line with the minimum qualification requirements that we need for the different functions within the compensation fund. We need to enrich and enhance the work that our medical case coordinators and adjudicators do, so that we can continue to be a bit more closer to the injured workers than we have been in the past. We looked at also the talent management strategy that we needed, so that we can also try and help people, those that are applying for bursaries, to address the skills gaps that we've identified in the skills audit, that their talent is managed towards achieving the competency gaps that we've identified. So when we did the skills audit has actually identified that a number of, we have a high concentration of, where people have qualifications, there's a high concentration of social services qualifications. When the compensation fund needs clinical qualification, medical qualifications, financial management qualifications, and actuarial qualifications. So, and we have found that a lot of the bursary applications that we continue to get from staff were aimed at achieving, at getting social services qualifications than the skills that we needed. So as part of this talent retention and management strategy was to try and help and work out a way that we can then get staff to start focusing on the areas where the gaps have been identified as where we need people. We needed also the established the accounting training office to address the skills in the fund from January 2020. We will be training chartered accountants in the compensation fund, so people that will be doing articles can do articles also at the compensation fund towards achieving their chartered accountancy training program. So we established that training office. That's part of the way that we can help address the skill gaps we have in the fund, plus make sure that we also contribute to. So this, in a nutshell, is the action plan of the fund. So the subsequent slide is just an indication of how, as September, this is just a progress report as of September in terms of the activities that we have. Go to the next slide. The how far we have come in implementing a lot of these things. You'll see that about 40% of the activities that are in this action plan, the 192 activities, about 40% of those have already been completed. That was at the end of September, and about 59% of these are in progress. Only about 1% of them not having started, because they may be having, they have a dependency on some of the activities that we need to complete before we can start with the other slides. The subsequent slides, Chair, I will not touch on them. It's just the breaking down this performance that I reported there in terms of the different pillars. If you go to the last two slides, that talk to the high level achievements of the as part of implementing this particular action plan, we needed to implement the claims management system. The claims management system that we've gone live on in October now, the country, also is going to help us to address a number of the issues that are in the action plan. Among those is these that are listed here, the issues around data analytics, switching house, teaching for clients, implementation of a training solution to upload documents, implementing a desk report for the system in terms of the report that we need for the work that we do, segregation of duties, linking of injuries to ICD-10 codes, reconciliations of claims, validation of medical service providers against third parties, and the issues that have been highlighted with regard to the role metrics and so on. So the number of the things that we will achieve then as a result of the implementation of the system that has been there. We also implemented a bank verification system. Now, before we pay a claim, we have a process to verify the banking details, that this banking details belongs to the ID number that you are paying. So there is also an automated process that helps us to be able to then make sure that we pay the right person. There's a number of issues that were raised by the AG in the next slide. That are part of the disclaimers on benefits, accounting for claims, intentions or some of the issues, the governance on who has what role to do what. Those are the concern weaknesses that we identified that we can help them with the system. Issue of infrastructure, that also has been addressed in the new system. The role metrics has been addressed. The issues around the auto payment of claims, that also has been implemented and addressed in the system. The online pre-authorization is also one of those that we implemented in the new system. We have also initiated legal proceedings to recover those advance payments, for example, that are highlighted in the public protector's report, and some of them were issues that have been raised also in the past in the fund that are part of the regular expenditure that has been reported in the fund. There is a process to that we started about a year and a half ago to then recover from the service provider that has been paid this advance payment. With two of the service providers, we're actually in the process now of entering into agreements with them to be able to offset a lot of these advance payments against the claims that they have in the fund, because those are the people that are then treating our clients. So they still have active life claims that they are submitting because they continue to see our clients. So we'll then be offsetting those monies against the invoices that they've submitted so that we can clear these items. And we've also done a lot of work on our supply chain management systems and policies. You see in the public protector report, one of the recommendations they were making was to an assessment to be done on the supply chain management environment and implement action plans to address these. Now, these reports were investigating items that have happened years in the past. And part of the work that we've done in the last 4 years has been to address these supply chain management weaknesses and processes. And just before the public protector issued the report, we had actually done an internal, we had requested internal audits to do an assessment of the environment, supply chain environment in the fund now, to look at whether the gaps that have been identified in the past are still existing. And a lot of all these gaps have been addressed. That's why we don't have any incidents of fruitless and wasteful expenditure at the same rate that we had in the past in the organization. That's the end of my presentation.
No, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, just last point on the issue raised by the Minister on the domestic worker High Court challenge. A lady by the name of Maria Matan, who was employed as a domestic worker and worked for 22 years. She slipped on a step that and fell into a swimming pool and passed away. The family then approached the compensation fund, rightfully so, and inquired about whether they could claim. And the existing legislation does not make provision for domestic workers, because it does not recognize them as employees. In the definition of an employee, they are not covered. So the matter then was taken to court by an institution called Social Economic Rights Institute. They then brought this application on behalf of Ms. Mahlangu to compel compensation fund to amend section 1 of the COIT Act, which excludes the domestic workers. So on the 23rd of May, the Pretoria High Court found that the exclusion of domestic workers in the COIT Act is unconstitutional. So the judgment may be applied retrospectively. And that's the point that we were arguing. We're not, as a department, we're not arguing the unconstitutionality of the provision, because we were anyway in the process of amending the COIT Act. We already have a COIT bill, and part of the amendments is the inclusion, or is to make a provision for the inclusion of the domestic workers, as they are already covered by the unemployment insurance fund. So that's where the matter is. The matter will then, sometime next year, will go to the Constitutional Court, where the Constitutional Court will confirm the judgment of the High Court, Pretoria High Court, on whether indeed that Section 1 of the Compensation Fund is unconstitutional. And the and whether that judgment applies retrospectively, I think that's the only contention that we have as a department. How far do you go if it applies retrospectively? We're looking at the ability of the fund to be able to pay. If it's applied, you know, as far back as the last 2 years, for instance, and then we're sitting with the problem. But we'll ask our actuarial to do an actual evaluation of whether we'll be able to do that, because that's what we must take to court, the Constitutional Court, that ability of the fund to pay.
It's quite an interesting case, which to me also representing, pardon my ignorance, what do you classify, it comes to my mind because of the thing of the swimming pool and whatever, where do you classify gardeners? Do they fall under the domestic worker? Now the question is, are they aware? Maybe that is not for now. Because the more you are exposed to teaching on these things, the more you look into a number of areas where maybe our people may not be aware of. But I think this is quite an interesting case, quite challenging. I read it and they were eagerly awaiting it. What the Concord is then going to say. The other arguments that you are advancing where we'll say at that time whether to engage or the portfolio committee to I hear what you say, how far do we go? And I think, honourable members, that has been an information that we needed to be more exposed to the challenges of the compensation fund and what then the action plan is, what is entailed within the action plan and what then the department is doing from that particular time up to now. What I will then do, I will then open for questions to members, because it has been quite an extensive and comprehensive report. I would request that we will have two rounds of questions. The first round will be 3 and the next round will be 3, depending on how then the department responds in the first round. Over to you, honourable members. Honourable Bakram, your hand is up. Can I get another hand? Your medium question. Honourable Mulawuti, Honourable Mufede, in that order. I will be here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll go ahead. Thank you. It was a lengthy report and a lot of it was repetition, I think. And I'd say the majority of the report, or at least half of it, is what they're going to do in the future. So obviously we can't question that. We'll keep the report and then test you in the next few months. So without question that, I wish you great strength to your arm. And also what we can't question is what you say you're busy doing right now. We haven't had any oversight on that, so we'll check up on that as well. I do have a whole lot of questions. I see that you're giving me 3 questions, but obviously I have dozens that I will be following up with the commissioner directly, as he knows, in due course. I do want to make some comments as well. Obviously with the domestic workers, I want to make a comment on that because I'm angry. And the DG will know that 5 years ago, he was challenged at this committee as an oversight committee to say, hurry up and get this done. He promised us it would be, it's in the works, they're busy wording it. That was 5 years ago. And now to say that domestics might not get back pay for 5 years is disingenuous. It's dishonest and it's disingenuous. And to go and argue that, I think, is absolutely wrong. Because that's been challenged for years. It's a disgrace. It's an old apartheid piece of legislation endorsed by this government, and I think it's wrong. So that's my comment on the domestics. And I'm very pleased that at least one person came forward, Ms. Mishlangu.
I'm not trying to be defensive. I understood the department by saying they are, the quotas, they are amending it. I thought that then is a process that is then going to be addressing the concern. That's why I'm saying, if I was listening, I think that's what he then alluded to.
No. He said he was amending it 6 years ago. And that's why I'm saying, when they made to the Constitutional Court, they need to tell the Constitutional Court that they were supposed to amend it 6 years ago and they forgot. And that's what, I'm not going to wait for these amendments to go through. It'll happen after the Constitutional Court challenge. And I want to have my say on that. I think it's absolutely wrong. Then if I can go to, I'll go through the first few questions I have. As I said, I have dozens. But maybe this is not the time and place for it. I will address them directly. The first one is in phase one, the action plan, and slide 3, I think it is. It was implemented, the first phase was implemented in July 15 to April 18. My estimation is on their old system, the old computer system, I think they spent, the DG had said they spent 300 million rand, or 200 million rand, I think a million here or there makes no difference, on that old system. I don't know why they didn't pick up that it wasn't working in any event, because they had spent 6 years on that old system throwing money at it. Phase two, when you moved into phase two, you found that there were a whole lot of wrongdoing, fraud, etc. from staff. How many prosecutions have, how many people are sitting in jail? I think the department's reluctant to basically act on what the AG reports are telling us, and I have a problem about that. On slide 4, if you have a look, it says a high number of AG audit findings have not been dealt with over a number of years. Well, whose fault is that other than you? It hadn't been dealt with over a number of years, it was just ignored. It's all very well now putting it in a problem statement and almost washing your hands off it. I suspect there's still many of the audit findings that have not been dealt with. We go to slide 5, a pure poor communication within the fund. I may say that it's pure poor communication outside the fund as well. While I'm sitting here, I'm getting constant complaints from people who are telling us that no one communicates with them. They didn't get their pension this month, for instance, or last month. Because you've still got problems, and no one communicates. No one tells people, goes back and says, by the way, you're not going to get your pension, the stop orders are going to bounce. There's no communication at all. It's all very well putting fancy adverts, and I've seen them, in all the newspapers and on the radio stations, but you should communicate with your customers. You don't seem to be interested in that for some reason or other. I can read out the complaints that I've received in the last 15 minutes. You said on slide 6, stop me ma'am when you've heard enough from me because I want to go through them. You said about six that there's volumes of unpaid medical claims. From what I understand is that's ongoing. There's still volumes of unpaid medical claims, and still the doctors are not wanting to see patients who come with workman's compensation claims. They're not interested in seeing them, and including the institutions, the hospitals. They just don't, they're not really interested. And that goes for all the medical service providers. I'm not sure what you mean on slide 7 that the medical service providers want to destabilize the fund systems. Maybe unpack that, because there might be crooks out there, and let's hear about it so we can challenge them and they come to us to say what's going on. And then you have the involvement of third parties, also on slide 7. You're forcing them to go to third parties. People are not getting answers, they're not getting paid, and they think they have to then go to a third party who might be more successful. People don't want to spend money. Like they have joy out of the CCMA or the UIF. They don't want to go to a third party. They'd rather go straight there. But you're forcing them to go to those third parties, and you can't blame them afterwards. You said on slide 8, the lack of accountability, no consequences. And may I dare say again, there's still no consequences. I still don't see lots of prosecutions. I don't see people going to jail. I don't think there's any consequences at all. And that would lead to staff morale, obviously. You can't expect staff to be happy if they know that some of their seniors have got their fingers in the cookie jar, as it were.
I requested that you have
okay, I'll start.
So that we don't load it around with so many questions and we miss some of the things that are the honorable note. In the next round, we will continue with the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. And let me welcome the presentation by the DG. I have some few clarities and questions. Let's start with the presentation about the first one, about the problem statement. You said there is there was an inability to produce accurate monthly financial statements and the inadequate capacity in the chief directorate, mostly in finance management. So just want to know, DG, what are the consequent management done in terms of this low standard of doing work, government work in the fund? The other thing you told us about the refusal that the medical providers to assist, you said it was because of lack of payment. What was the cause of lack of payment? Was the fund maybe didn't have money to pay them, or was due to the laziness by the officials? If so, any consequent management taken by the president of the fund itself? The other thing is that you appointed medical service providers from various provinces. Can we get a detailed report of which, how many per province out of 9 provinces, and where are they stationed? Are they centralized in the small capital cities like maybe if we are say Northern Cape, Upington or Kimberley or where? Can we get a detailed report about that? Even if you don't have it now, you can write the report to the secretary of the committee so that you can be opportuned about that. And you said there are medical providers who destabilize the fund system for their own advantage. Do you mean the medical providers who are doing that, they hacked the system of the fund? What advantage are they getting to destabilize the fund? How? Can you explain more about that so that we must be clear Is it a criminal activity which is happening between the service to provide an external provider and the fund? And you said the general unhappiness with the salary level by the workers of the fund. Are the workers of the fund not so getting the salary level like the government employees? If so, can we be detailed why are they having a problem there? Now I will ask another question that to the next round, just for thank you.
First, thank you, Chair. Chair, let's welcome the presentation of the action plans by the government, in particular the compensation fund for the steps that they are in fact intending to put in place or already rolling out. Obviously, this chair speaks to the issues that were raised previously, with particular to the areas that we noted that have led to the negative or adverse audit outcomes that the fund has experienced over a long period. But that there are just areas of clarity that one wants to take, and whether it would also just to also to make suggestions where possible. The first area here relates to the that is slide 28 on service delivery and performance improvement. There's a point there with regard to procurement of mobile clinics and buses for increased access and accessibility of services. The issue here is the concern firstly with regard to the rollout of NHI program. Secondly, the bus going into an area, say in a rural village, and attending one person out of the whole community. The third point is actually the whole story of buses that has been in the news, the Mediosa type of stories. Whether, for instance, is it not going to be helpful rather to investigate, rather to provide the members with the medical cards that would make it easy for them to access services in the NHI clinics or including private institutions, because the medical cards are more accredited. They have access and they are guaranteed for payment. My worry is that we would come back to, without being negative, we'll come back to talk about the buses. Can we limit or just opt for a much more manageable and affordable system that would be used by the patients? The second point on the same section on the slide 83 is with regard to the training of students. The principle is fine, but I'm worried that the people who really work on the on that area are not the target of the training program. Because if we talk in terms of workplace experience, whether, for instance, is it not necessary, for instance, to rather direct the training there, and so that you are able, therefore, to minimize the kind of experiences that were had to go through the visit by the minister to various unattended cases that have been there for quite long. Yeah, whether we should not make that kind of priority. Obviously, investing into the future, partnering with the institutions of higher learning and making the skills base much more wider is fine. But I thought maybe it would help as well to say, to address the problem where currently it exists, that is of absence of the appreciation and understanding of the of the act, that is the workplace. That is the problem, maybe partnering with unions or labor federations running that kind of program. On slide 34, just to check on slide 34 whether, for instance, it is not going to be helpful to agree that those points, rather they be taken as points for implementation. I just want to read them.
Come again.
That is page 34.
Okay.
Your slide 34, starting with investing the possibility of using the electronic database. And the following one, investigate the possibility of building the electronic database of pensioners, the automated process of payment of claims management system, up to the online training portal, and so on. Rather than to put it into a process, because this in fact eliminates the kind of bottlenecks that we currently experience with regard to accessibility of the benefits by the members. It's a question, it's not a proposal. It's a question whether we should not rather consider to say we would want to implement. The next area,
you know why I'm so upset? I'm struggling. I'm trying to get. You said slide 34.
Slide 34, yes.
Mm-hmm. And slide 34.
Slide 34. That is the bullet starting with investigate, which is the third bullet on that page.
From that bullet.
Yeah, fourth. Oh. That is bullet 4, bullet 5, bullet 6, and bullet 7. Yes. Five. Yeah, they are put as the points that are still being thought through, not necessarily projected for implementation. The question is whether, for instance, should we not say rather commit that we will be doing that? Yeah. I would hold you back on the question because I don't want to also to flood the question.
Okay.
I will hold back on the other question and raise on the second round.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let us welcome the presentation by both the DG as well as the Commissioner. Really, you have given us a lot of information. And this information, Chair, requires maybe a full day discussion in terms of the action plans based on the areas that we raised with both the entity as well as the board. On a lighter note, Chair, the issues we raised with the board in terms of the their oversight role, if you look at the amount of information presented to us, it raises the question that it amplifies the question that we were asking in terms of their capability of playing an oversight over this matter or over this fund. I have quite a number of questions, but for the sake of what the Chair said, I would maybe ask about four for the first round. Firstly is the question on the clarity on the oversight committee that you raise as far as their interference with the administrative processes. If we can be clarified what is meant by these oversight committees wanting to be involved in the administrative matters of UFA. And then the second one is the clarity as well on consultants that have been procured for the same service, whether there were no terms of reference put in place in terms of who is responsible, who would be responsible for what, or why are you employing this service provider, so that it is clear that when you employ the other service provider, the issues of the same service is eliminated, and therefore you would develop a contract for engagement with that particular a service provider. Was it not therefore then detected at the time? Now, there is an issue as well on the over-reliance on ICT service providers. What has been therefore, or what doesn't come out clear, is the action plan to address that particular matter. If there is there therefore a unit identified to deal with ICT in the fund? The last one for this round, Chair, it's unregulated and undefined third parties. It links with the issue of possible fraud and collusion between the doctors and the patient. How the department has put in place mechanisms to detect that. Understood the part of the unit that would look at matters of fraud and corruption outside of risk. Was this therefore then identified as a risk factor by either the internal unit or a risk audit committee? Or is it a matter that excluded or possibly focused mainly on the legal unit? Thanks, Jay.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. We will we'll allow the department to, if it is ready to respond on these questions now and these clarities, we allow that to happen so that we go to the second round. If we just need a 5 minute comfort break, so that we then come back, we will indicate, DG, if you are ready for us. We are ready. Okay. You can stop.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it was deliberate on our part to, and also it was for the purpose of informing the committee of. Because the committee is a new committee of where we come from in the compensation fund. So it was important that we start from the beginning and highlight those things that we found them to be the cause of the challenges that we experience in the compensation fund. So if there was any misunderstanding of the reason why we highlighted those things, maybe it was not because we explained it properly, because
the manner in which Honorable Bakrain raised the question, it's as if that those things are happening now and that we haven't done anything to resolve these issues, and that's why we're talking about the second iteration of the action plan. I want to go back to the point that the compensation that we're supposed to have amended the law 6 years ago. Certainly that the matter relating to amendment of the COIT Act 6 years ago was not raised with me, because I've only been in the in this portfolio for, I've not even finished my 5 years. It's ending on the 31st of November this year. But the matter was raised, it's correct to say it was raised. And when it was raised, we indicated the processes that we followed, because the process of developing legislation, unfortunately, is a long process, and we would like to have it, you know, you have to go to a number of stages. You have to do the impact assessment. You then have to go to NEDLAC, and you have to so all sorts of processes that would, even ourselves, we're not happy with, but unfortunately have to go through. So that is why for us the matter of this domestic worker wasn't really a matter that we opposed, because we were clear that COIT Act is unconstitutional for not including the domestic workers. But we also have to be realistic. Will the fund be able to pay? Mm. I think that's the thinking that we have. And if the court says it's endless, we've got processes. This doesn't mean that every claim is a claim that will take liability for. It will have to go through the processes, and if indeed it's something that we have to take liability for, we will take liability. And if not, the processes will be followed. But it's something that we needed to raise. So the bill is out there, and it's going to come back to the committee so that it can be finalized. On whether we have taken steps, and Honorable Bakrain says he has not had any case that has gone for prosecution. I just want to read this chat as a response to that question. And the countless other cases that we have referred to SAPS and NPA. And incidentally, this week I signed a submission which was going to the minister, asking the minister to write, to send a letter to the Minister of Police and the Minister of Justice, just nudging them to expedite the cases that we refer to them, because we're not seeing progress in certain areas. Certainly in some areas there is progress. And this case that I'm gonna talk about is just a case in point, that two former employees of the Department of Employment and Labour appeared in the East London Court on September 11 for allegedly submitting fraudulent claims to the compensation fund. So I'm not gonna go and read the entire, but just to illustrate a point that we do take cases to court, we do follow the due process. It's frustrating, it may take longer, but certainly there is there's work that we are doing. We have dismissed a number of our employees as a result of being complicit. We have a number of doctors actually have been found guilty of having defrauded the fund. In KZN, And certainly I know there was a case last year of a gentleman who has the same surname as the president. And people thought that it was the president because the headlines were saying Ramaphosa and so were found guilty defrauding the fact. When we spoke about the high number of age findings that were not dealt with, I think the commissioner went, a step further to explain that initially when we started, which was 2014-15, the fund had a serious number of age findings. And a number of those were repeat findings, which we have worked tirelessly to reduce. And in our view is that there was no attempt to even resolve these cases. They were there, and they were there. We had to accept that the findings and the operations continued, and that's why we stepped in and we did what we did, and we were clear from the beginning, Chair, that given the challenges of the compensation fund, there was no way that within a short space of time we could intervene and the fund would have disclaimed, would have a
clean audit.
And we said that to AG, we said that to SCOPA, and we said it to the committee. We were clear that given the steps that we have to take and the time that it will take for us to achieve this thing, it's going to take us a bit of time. And we are now at a stage where we think that a number of these things that were raised by AG are just falling, because we were clear again that our strategy is not targeted at addressing age findings. And our idea was that we're trying to take this patient out of ICU into a normal ward. And we needed to take steps to do that, and that's what we did. And we're now at the stage where we think that because we're addressing these things, the age findings are just gonna fall off by themselves, because we're dealing with the root causes of the problems, not the symptoms. We're dealing with the root causes. I think I'll leave it to the commissioner to deal with the issue of pensioners that were not paid recently. But I do know that there was a communication that was sent out with regards to the fact that because we have to switch off the old system and we're migrating data into the new system, the pensioners would be affected. But the commissioner will talk to it. When we spoke about volumes of unpaid medical claims, again, it was because of the old, we were reflecting on the old ways of doing things. And we've been consistent in coming to the committee when we report to say, these are the number of claims that we've paid. And we will do a year-on-year comparison to say, last year we did this, and this is how much we've done now. So there's been a considerable improvement in terms of the ability of the fund to pay claims. So this is again what we were talking about with regards to what was happening in the past. And the fact that doctors, they still don't want to see CF complaints, I have not been made aware of that. I think that the commissioner would deal with that, but as far as I know, that a lot of work has been done in assuring service providers that when they deal with the compensation fund clients, they will be paid, and indeed they have been paid. If there are instances of examples where things happening, we would like to know, and so that we can act on it. Unpacking the involvement of doctors to destabilize the fund, we are on record, and the courts have validated this, that indeed there are medical doctors who have been working with our staff and patients as well to destabilize the fund, defraud the fund, and that's why we're able to retrieve some of these court cases where doctors have been found guilty for colluding with our staff to defraud the fund. So, and certainly, when you say there are no consequences, there have been consequences. There's a doctor that was sentenced to 7 years imprisonment for defrauding the compensation fund to a tune of about 400,000. So, and that's only in 2017, you know, and in 2017, again, 35 employees were put under precautionary suspension while allegations of fraud were being investigated. So I'm just indicating the steps that we've taken as a department to deal with this matter. The inability to produce financial statements and non-compliance to SAM processes. At the time, the fund was not in a position to produce financial statements because the financial management capabilities were non-existent. So the commissioner indicated earlier on that when we did the skills audit, the skills audit revealed that the skills that people had there were mainly social science skills, whereas that's a financial institution. You need people with finance skills, medical skills, and actuarial skills. So it was not something that they could do because they didn't have the capacity to do so. So that's why we took steps to address this matter. And we have, as the commissioner indicated, that we are taking steps even now to build the capacity of finance a unit. The non-compliance to SAM and the lack of consequence management, like I indicated, everything that comes our way, we investigate it. And if found that you've transgressed any SAM policy or any police of the department, you are dealt with. I haven't seen anyone who has escaped this and having found the guilty. I remember that as a consequence of the investigation that was done by Sizwe and Baluba and Koboto, we had to suspend the CFO of the fund, and he went through this process, and he wasn't found guilty. But because I did not have faith in his ability to do his work, I removed him as a CFO and placed him elsewhere. But he went through the process. Are you going to say there's no consequence management there? There is. And I sometimes think that the use of a term consequence management implies that people must be fired. You know, there are various sanctions that you can impose and still, you know, show that there was consequence management. What was the result of lack of payment of claims by the fund? Of course, this resulted in a number of litigation. We were taken to court about some of these third parties because they bought the rights to the claims of the certain doctors and the institution, and they took us to court. So we're grappling with a high rate of court cases, and we had to work through those court cases. Whilst we're also improving our ability to process and adjudicate claims. I think I responded to the issue of medical practitioners destabilizing the fund. The unhappiness of staff with salary levels. We went through, I think the commissioner will add on this, we went through the process of decentralization, which was not dealt with properly as far as we're concerned. There was a change management, and the relocation costs and all these things. Some employees were relocated, some were not, and the department paid for relocation, the compensation fund paid for relocation costs for others and didn't pay for others. So we had those complaints that we had to go through and resolve, which thanks God we were able to resolve. And that led to this unhappiness. And the fact that if you are at the same level with someone who's sitting at UIF and you are at the compensation fund, you're paid at a different level. So we have to work through those and make sure that that adjustment in certain cases where there was a need, the justification for it, it was done. And on slide 28, I think the commissioner will deal with the impact of the rollout of AHI. I just want to talk about this issue of buses going to the villages and all. We've had a number of, I think we've had buses that will be procured at some point, because for us it's important that we go to these areas and service them, because it's impossible to put a brick and mortar structure in a number of these areas. So it's important that when we procure a bus, and we make sure that the bus has got all the the technology and the facilities that it requires to have, like in any other mobile office, so I'm able to do the work that we do as a department. It's not about one person being attended to. So if you go to an area, it will be because we were there doing other things, and that there's just one person who we need to service, who stays in this area, who's a patient with the compensation fund that requires medical assistance, or we need to deliver a prosthesis or a wheelchair, or and that we can use the buses for that. We already have two buses that we have in the department that are able to go to some of the areas. And of course we are aware of the media statements with regards to some provinces. We're not there, and we make sure that we do things according to the book, the department. Fortunately, we haven't had situations where we have been found, we have not been doing things the way we should be. On the training of students, I agree with you, because it's important that we focus on the people who are currently doing their work, empower them, and that's what is happening. That is happening. And this other program that we have of training of young people on the different areas that we require skills and competences in is a very important area of work. In fact, Commissioner, there are some of our staff members who have been given the opportunity to go through this, to be trained in this area of our work. We give priority to them as well, so it's not like that they are excluded. I agree with you. It may have sounded as though we put this as exploratory work must be done. Once we've made the determination as an outcome of the investigation, we then implement this, because that's what we want to do. The interference of the oversight committees. So this is what we found. You will find that an audit committee would then sit and provide a solution to the institution, and even go to the extent of saying, we think that you can use this service provider. So we had to step in and say, no, you're overstepping your boundary here. your role as an oversight structure is merely that, to say in this area there are no internal controls. Tighten this area, tighten that area, but you can't prescribe a solution, because the danger is that once you prescribe a solution and that solution doesn't work, then you party to the failures by management not to implement or to come up with solutions that are working. So we have to deal with those and say to the audit committees, look, and also we have to deal with issues where we're saying that the board was also had a subcommittee responsible for investment. So the board had somebody who was interfacing between the compensation fund and the PIC. So we said, they had to say, no, the commissioner is the one who is responsible for the investments of the fund. So it can't be anyone from the board who runs around and go and talk to the PIC. No. This is the person who must go and talk to the PIC. So again, it's the overstepping of the boundaries by the oversight committee. On the terms of reference for service providers to avoid duplicating the work done by others, I think we've gone a long way. And if we were to give you today a list that we gave to a portfolio committee when we started, a list of consultants that were operating in the compensation fund space, and the number of consultants that we have there now, the number has dropped significantly. And one of the things that we picked up was that, for instance, in the finance space, you have two or three service providers, and each service provider wouldn't know what the other is doing, because we were not following these things. That has changed. Now, if you're a service provider, we know exactly what you're going to do and why you're there, and we expect that you do 1, 2, 3, 4, because there's proper monitoring of the work that we've done. Things have changed, and again, we were reflecting what we found. They're similar to the over-reliance on the IT service providers. We have a new structure of the fund, and we've made provision for ICT capabilities within the compensation fund. Is it enough? Certainly, I don't think it's enough. We're working towards making sure that we provide as much as much resources as possible, so the fund is able to do the work that it's supposed to do. Possible fraud between the doctors and patients, I think I've reflected on this already. We had very ineffective risk and internal audit, and that's why we had to reinforce them, and for us it was important also to have this fraud and risk, anti-corruption and fraud unit that is distinct from your normal risk management unit, so that it can focus on these cases where your risk unit would have flagged them as areas that are requiring attention. I think I'll ask the commissioner to respond.
Thank you, Chair. So just address those issues that you would not have responded to, or you wanted me to just expand on it. Maybe starting with the issue of the pension that was raised by Honorable Greg. What I indicated earlier on, that one of the things that we're bringing with the new system is also the account verification process, so that we make sure that we pay the right person when we pay pensions. So this is the first month that we've cut over into the new system. And there's a lot of verification that needed to be done from some of the pensions, for example. So you find a situation where on the 25th, which is the day on which the pensioners are supposed to be paid. Almost about half of the 27,000 pensioners will then be paid on the 25th after the payment information passed verification is the process that we use. And the remaining will then have to wait. Either there's a missing information with regard to the bank details and so on that need to have been corrected. And the communication that the DG speaks about, I think, is a communique that we issued also on the same day to say that if you have not been paid, you can come forward, because it then means that there's information that may be missing on your pensions and so on. But as we speak now, everyone has been paid. So I think it's going to be part of the process going forward up until such time that everyone's details have been correctly verified. And this is one of the ways that we make sure that we protect the pensions of the beneficiaries so that they are the ones that get the pension, but not somebody else outside. We're also commenting on the issue of the third parties that destabilize the fund. The DG spoke about the medical practitioners and so on. So we have a practice in this country where, for example, we have two of these kind of service providers that would go to medical practitioners. So their business case is that I can pay you or make sure that you get paid your money for treating compensation fund pensioners much quicker than you can get it from the compensation fund. So how they do that is that they will pre-fund the doctors. If I treat a client to the value of 1 rand, they will then buy that invoice for 65 cents. They give you 65 cents, you get your money up front, and then they will go and submit that claim to the compensation fund on your behalf and then recover the money from you. If the compensation fund does not accept liability for the claim, you then have to refund them back based on whatever contract that you have with them. Now, so these companies, their business case is strong for as long as the compensation fund doesn't pay doctors. Because every doctor will see, or a hospital will see, the need to go to them, because with them they can get their money much quicker than if they come directly to the fund. So they will make sure that the fund never gets to a point where they pay, so that they can continue to have their business case. So when we spoke about how they destabilize, some of the things, for example, there would be where they would flood the system with invoices that you would have to work through, because we didn't have a structured rules on the system to say medical invoice must come in with these and these requirements, so that if it passes that requirement, they'll be able to process it and pay it. So they send every junk that they can send. Then our team has to spend countless days working through the junk that they submitted. In the meantime, they will be saying to people, we see, we told you the compensation fund can't pay quickly. So come to us and then we'll pay. So that's the destabilization that they would do over and above them submitting fraudulent or claims that would appear to be fraudulent that we end up having to reject and so on. So we have a history, and the history is highlighted in this problem statement that we have, that we have a history of not paying as effective as we should, in some cases having not paid doctors and medical practitioners and medical service providers for extended periods of time. So over time, and this has led to a lot of service providers then taking a decision not to treat COVID patients. So part of the work that we've done in the past is to try and then work with this to show that we have improved and we pay. So we have a large number of medical practitioners now who are accepting COVID patients, but then you have isolated incidents of some of the practitioners that would say, I've bent my fingers with COVID, I'm not going to treat any COVID patients. So you would walk into some of the hospitals, you find a casualty, there would be a sign that says, we don't do COVID patients and so on. So and that's going to be a work in progress to try and get everyone to change their attitude and mind towards the, but certainly not a majority that we've had in the past. I think they're in a minority, those that would not want to treat the fund. The suggestion that instead of the mobile buses, we look at card system and people going to NHI facilities and so on. So the way that COIDA works, as soon as you've accepted liability and you have a claim number and you're going through medical treatment, that's your medical aid. So now the law says that this will be applicable to you for a period of 24 months while you're going through treatment. Go to a hospital that, or the doctor that is treating you. With that claim number, you need to pay, so that's the medical aid that you want. So the way we want to use mobile clinics and buses is that there's incidences where, for example, we go to our pensioners, but we want to check, because what we don't do is, once a person has gone through the 24-month treatment period, our only responsibility and obligation is to pay the pensions if a person is a pensioner. Unless when a person goes to a doctor because of some complications that develop and the doctor has to apply for the claim to reopen so that the person can go for further medical treatment and so on. But when you use the bans, because what we're saying is that we're not doing enough for our pensioners. So we don't do those kind of assessments where we go to them and say, look, we just want to check what is your general state of health. Has your condition worsened your disability? Has it improved your disability? What is it that we can do to try and improve your condition of that you have? So that's the context within which we want to use the buses. It's not going to be like a treatment that every person has to go through. But also we often send people would also complain and say, I don't think my claim has been fairly dealt with. And we'll say, but we dealt with your claim in accordance to the medical report that your doctor has provided. So one of the ways that we deal with that is to say that in terms of the law, there's a section 42 of the COIN Act says that we can send a person for medical examination. So that once we send for medical examination, that report that we get from the doctor, we may then use to review the decision that we've taken on the claim. So we want to be able to use some of these buses to do exactly those facilities, because sometimes we don't need to be spending a lot of money to send a person to a hospital to do a section 42, and that can be done remotely. I think the last part is this, on the unregulated and undefined third parties, there was a question that was asked, when did this internal audit or risk and legal issue that has been discovered. So this is in two ways. Now, there is no law that prevents an employer or medical service provider from using another person to be an intermediary to submit information on his or her behalf to the fund. But there's control weaknesses to that, because we may have people that submit claims on behalf of an employer when the person was never mandated by the employer to submit the claims on his behalf. A person who submits a medical claim on behalf of a doctor when he was never mandated. So, and this was a practice process that was managed outside the system. We just see an employer, someone submitting documents on behalf of the employer. When you go to the employer to audit the claims, says, but I don't know this person and that person that you're saying the claim has been opened against, who worked for me, this person never worked for me, and so on. So what we, in the amendments to the COIDA legislation, we are explicit on saying we will not accept any claim that has been submitted by a person who didn't treat the client, for example. We're dealing with these guys that will go to doctors and promise them money in exchange for their invoices to claim for us. But we are not regulating who the employer must use to submit their invoices, because the employers would say, my strength is in delivering, in doing what I'm expected to do. Any administration, I'm going to outsource it to someone else, my accountant or whoever. But to improve the controls there, in the new system, we actually, all employers were requested at the beginning of October to register afresh. And one of the new rules that we've published now that we've gazetted also is that if you are going to be assigning someone to do work on your behalf, we need to have a power of attorney signed by the employer, and we'll only assign the ability for that person to submit claims on your behalf if they have the necessary documents. And those documents will then need to be scanned onto the system and attached before, and then it doesn't become an automatic process as well. Once you've submitted that and you've registered, we won't even give you any user profiles on the system until we verify the information with the employer. And once the employer has confirmed that this person is doing work for me, we then assign them the role to submit on behalf of the employer. Thank you very much. I think we can provide that list to check. And so there is a lot of requested for staff that is in the province.
Thank you. I'm informed that there is going to be no lunch because the secretary has looked into the, it's only one item. And they assumed that that item is just going to be a walkover. I'm saying this because I would have, because it's for the first time that we we got a detailed presentation as we requested, and that necessitated questions, a lot of questions to be asked. They are still other reports that we would have maybe interacted, in particular the KP report. And the information that I got is that the SIU was tabled in the former president's state office. So that means the office of the chair, we have to check with the presidency together with the minister, together with the department, because we will have to be aware of exactly what are the things that have been raised, so that we don't speak as if we and ask for things that have then been checked and must get a response, so that as we'll be conducting our oversight, we're able to do that being informed. I then said there will be a second round. I don't have a problem with the second round, but the implication of the second round is that it's likely to take us beyond 2 o'clock. If that's what you want, it's fine. The rambling again, because I don't understand.
I haven't noted you. Sorry?
I haven't noted you. No. Okay. So that is what I don't mind having a second round, but the implication of a second round in terms of listening to questions that were asked in the first round, it is likely to take us beyond 2 o'clock. Any response to that background, Honourable Notsele?
Yeah, I agree with you. A lot of us have guests coming to listen to Minister Mogweni, and we're meeting our guests in 15, 20 minutes. So I won't be able to be here, and I don't think it's fair to ask people to sit here, because I know everyone wants to get into Parliament quickly as possible. So I just don't think it's fair to do that. Thanks.
Honourable Chair, thanks. I think I agree with you. I was just concerned the court has been maybe important questions people want to ask, and whether it will not be a problem just to limit to one question per person rather than to a long list. Yeah. So that we can quickly dispense. Then it's upon them to prioritize each question out of the long list they have.
Yeah.
Can we agree? Because one question can have 10 questions. That I know. When all of the members speak, you say just one question, but in that one question, you'll pick up 3 questions. Can we agree that we continue with the compensation fund next week? Can we agree? We continue with the compensation fund next week, taking into consideration some of the issues that have been raised. I just, if then that is agreement, it's fine. From my side, DG, I would really request that we get the details. You know this thing of the scales, the challenges in the compensation fund, people with social, whatever. Can we get the details now of how many people are employed in the compensation fund in terms of gender, in terms of race, and in terms of age? And including, and how long have they been there? Because that is very important, so that we don't sit here and then the other questions, I think I'll raise them, but please, I just, when you come back next week, give us the total breakdown of who is who in the compensation fund, race, gender, period, and skills, disabled, all those. So that we don't have the back and forth. I on my side, I want to, and I will request members to, because this is not a secret, it's in the public domain. Go to this, the issues that you really want to, at that time, you then appreciate and thank you.